Okay, Boker Tov to everyone. So we'll look at Megillas Esther next couple of weeks, not next week, but the next few weeks, up to Purim. And I want to discuss this morning the really critical event in the Megillah, a Megillah that has many, many critical events, many turning points, and that's in Perek Dalet, the fourth Perek. Call this the dueling logic of Esther and Mordechai. So, what happens? Mordechai finds out about the king's decree. Ahasuerus was paid a lot of money by Haman to sweeten the deal, and essentially Ahasuerus gives Haman carte blanche to deal with this unnamed nation that's a destabilizing force and a threat to the kingdom, as he wishes, and Haman endeavors to kill them, and so sends out messages to all his minions in the 127 provinces. So Mordechai finds out what's happening. Vayikra Mordechai is bigadov, vayibash sak vayifer. He tears his garments, puts on sackcloth and ashes. Vayitze besoch ha'ir, vayizag ze'akoga delo maro. And he goes out in the middle of the city and starts to wail, starts to cry very bitterly, and he comes even into the king's gate, where you can't come dressed inappropriately. It's not like a shul where anything goes. Ahasuerus has standards. So you have to dress appropriately. You can't come in sackcloth. And as the news spread, v'chom medino u'medino, mekom asher dvar melech v'daso magia, in every province, wherever the king's word arrived, evil gadol la'yehudim, great mourning for the Jews, v'tzom u'v'chi, umispaid, fasting, crying, wailing, sak va'efer yutzaler abim. All Jews began to dress in sackcloth and ashes. It was a time of great despondency, depression, not to mention terror. One person didn't know about it, being sequestered in the palace. Vatavona naros ester v'sor hiseho v'yagidu lo. The maids, the aides to Esther came and told her about Mordechai. But she became very distressed. Why is Mordechai dressed in the at the king's entrance in sackcloth? Vatishlach bigodim la bishus Mordechai ulasir sakome alav veloki bel. So she sent clothing. She could dress normally. Take off his sackcloth. Refused. Vatikra Esther Lasoch, Misori Sehamelech. Esther then called Hasoch. Hasoch became the intermediary between Esther and Mordechai. Chazal say that was an aged Daniel who had been an advisor to Nebuchadnezzar, and he stayed on when Ahasuerus seized power from a successor to Nebuchadnezzar. Someone she could trust, someone known to her, known to Mordechai. Asher hamidlefanev v'tatzaveu al Mordechai. So she commands him to go to Mordechai, find out what's happening. It's Perek Dalet. Lodas mazev al mazev, to find out, you know, what's going on. V'yitze asoch al Mordechai. He goes out, rechov ha'ir, to the streets of the city. Asher lefnei shar ha'melech. Mordechai tells her exactly everything that happened, that's happening. V'yeis parashas ha-kesef, asher amar haman l'shkol al ginzei ha-melech b'yehudim l'abadam, including the entire phenomenon of the money, an exorbitant amount of money that Haman paid into the treasury for the right to exterminate the Jews. So you shouldn't think it was a whim. Obviously, they saw Ahasuerus as a bit unstable, wishy-washy, but now you see this is more serious, because not only is there an agreement and an edict of expulsion that was disseminated across the kingdom, but in fact money was exchanged, good money was paid for the right to do it. So now it becomes more of a business transaction. It's something that's formal, and not just talked about behind closed doors. V'es pashegin k'sav adas asher nitam b'shushan l'shmidam nasan l'haros es Esther u'l'hagid lo. And even a copy of the decree that Mordechai had obtained that discussed the that was disseminated in Shushan to destroy the Jews, he gave to Asoch in order to show Esther and to tell her the implications. Ulitzavo soleho, lavo el amelech, lishanenlo, ulavakesh milifonov alamo. And to command her, this is Mordechai's command, go to the king, plead with him, and beseech him on behalf of her people. Meaning, Mordechai said to Esther, go right to the king, situation is urgent, time is of the essence, I command you to go to the king and plead our case. Vayavo asoch pasuk tes, vayaged l'Esther, eis divrei Mordechai. The intermediary goes and conveys to Esther what Mordechai had said. Simple request, go to Achashverosh and plead on behalf of Klal Yisrael. Esther demurs. Vatomer Esther l'asoch. Esther says to the intermediary, and she commands him back to Mordechai. In essence, she can't accept his plan. All the servants of the king and the entire nation, each one of the 127 provinces, everybody knows, if there's one law that everyone knows, it's this. Asher kol ish v'isho, asher yavo el hamelech, any man, any woman who comes to the inner court of the king, asher lo yikore, who has not been called, not been summoned, not been invited, achas daso lehamis, then there's only one regulation that is in force, execution. Anyone who comes to the inner chamber of the king uninvited is subject to the death penalty immediately. No trial, no questions asked. And notice, everybody knows that's like the most popular, the most well-known law in the kingdom. Can't see the king unasked. Levad asher yoshit lo hamelech ashavid azo v'chayo. Except if the king extends his scepter, his golden scepter, then a person will live. But it is entirely up to the discretion of the king, and if you violate that, so death is the likely outcome. Everyone knows that. What's that based on? Paranoia, certainly. Security, for sure. It's a security measure. Achashverosh had seized power. How did he seize power? By killing his predecessor. Anyone who seizes power by killing, I guess in the modern context, killing is a little extreme in dictatorships, but even if you imprison your predecessor and take power, then you live in fear that another group will do the same to you. Is this ancient history? Yeah, like yesterday in Ukraine. That's what's going on. He had deposed the previous president, in a sense, won a corrupt election, and then put her in prison. And now on Shabbos, she came out of prison, and he's on the run. He's in hiding. That's Achashverosh, in a sense. So those are that's the regulation. Everyone knows it. The king lives in that fear. And I have not been to the king, not called to the king for a month, but you just can't show up uninvited. As a matter of fact, look at it this way. Uninvited visitors are executed. So if you come with an invitation, you're killed. What if you don't come when you have an invitation? Vashti, you're killed also. So that is really, they're really very limited options. If a person wants to have an audience with the king, you show up uninvited, they kill you. The king wants to see you don't come, he kills you also. So he has a very itchy trigger finger. And yet, Mordechai has a plan. Esther seems to be frustrating his plan. So in fact, how do we understand it? How do we understand Esther's response? Okay. Let's see. Why did Esther refuse to come? And what was Esther's plan in return? She doesn't say to Mordechai, I have a different approach. At least on the surface she doesn't. We'll see implicitly she does. But what in fact is Esther saying? So she says a number of things. First, if you come in, first you can't come uninvited. Secondly, if you come, then the only way you live is me'asher yoshit lo ha'melech ha'shavir ha'zal v'chayo. Then if the king grants you an audience by lifting his scepter, if you come and by some miracle you're spared, let's put it in the first person, she says, if I come uninvited, subject myself to his mercy, and he grants me, extends me that mercy, and I'm spared, then in a sense, I've expended all of my capital. That act of benevolence, from Ahasuerus's perspective, is enormous. So how then would I be in a position to ask for a second favor, to beg for the life of my people, if the king was just kind enough to spare my life? In other words, she says, that would be making two requests, not one. The first request is astonishing, because it's a breach of protocol. So if he grants her that request, one would think that he has done his favors for the day, and he would not look kindly on doing a second favor.
So she's really not afraid for herself. She's just afraid that the second favor will happen.
She says it's not going to work.
It's not going to work.
That's one argument. It won't work. Then she says something else. I haven't been there. I haven't been there for 30 days. What does that mean? On the one hand, it means he hasn't called her. On the second hand, it could mean he's about to call her. So then rather than rely on his compassion and be given an ex parte audience, I might as well wait. He's bound to call me soon, right? He's going to want to see me. So let me just wait a few days, and then when I come, I'll be in a better position to beseech on behalf of the people. And she said, in essence, what's the rush? Because you see, there's an edict, there's a decree. When was the decree to go into force? The 13th of Adar, the next year. What day are we talking about now? This is actually happening the 13th of Nisan. Day before Erev Pesach, the 13th of Nisan. So that's a full 11 months until the decree is going to go into effect. So why risk everything at this particular time? There's plenty of time. If we're more deliberate, if we're more patient, then things can change. In fact, how can they change? Maybe they'll change for the better. Maybe the situation will become better on its own, and it won't require that drastic effort of showing up at the palace unannounced. So Esther's argument is actually quite plausible. If you think about it, what is she counseling? In essence, though, passivity. Passivity. The Gemara says about Esther in a related context, Esther karka olami, that she's not liable for living in sin with Ahasuerus because she's completely passive. But she's saying, in effect, when a crisis comes, before you leap into action, the best thing to do first is to be patient. Get a broad perspective of everything that's possible. Maybe it can get better on its own. What could happen? Ahasuerus could die, be overthrown. Haman could die. Haman could be removed. The same Ahasuerus that is as unstable, as unpredictable, that he could suddenly decide to exterminate one of his peoples in his kingdom, he could change his mind the next day also and turn on Haman or someone else. So the plan that you have suggested, you say, I understand your sense of urgency, why you want to get the word out, why you want to nip it in the bud, so to speak, but nonetheless, it's much better to wait, because if I go in and I'm killed before even making the request, so what is your plan B? There is no plan B. So therefore, she said, wait. Vayagidul Mordechai Esther v'Esther. So Asach goes back to Mordechai. Actually, it doesn't say Asach. Medrash says that Daniel here was killed by Haman because he saw someone going back and forth between Haman and Mordechai. Didn't know what it was, though, and he just had him killed, which was part of the culture of the times. Anyway, Esther's message goes back to Mordechai, unnamed people, unnamed intermediaries. Vayomer Mordechai lo shiver l'Esther. Mordechai then sends message back to Esther. Al tidami v'nafsheich lehi maleid beis hamelech mikol hayudim. Do not delude yourself. Do not think that you'll be able to escape, to hide in the king's palace from the rest of the Jews. Don't think that your fate is going to be different than that of other Jews. Kim hachareish tacharishi, because if you are surely silent, bo'eis hazoz, at this time, you should know, revach v'atzalah ya'amod la'yehudim imakom acher. Relief, salvation, deliverance will come to the Jews from a different place. Ve'atu ve'savich tovedu, and you and your father's house will be lost, destroyed. Umi yodea im leis kazos higat l'malchus, and who will know if at this time, if for this time, you achieved royalty? Who knows that maybe this is the reason why you were placed in this position at this time? Well, how does Mordechai respond to Esther's logic? Esther's logic is compelling. You have to grant her that. What's the sense of risking everything on a whimsy? She's bound to be called to the palace at a future time. And if she comes and by some miracle is spared, so he will have exhausted his mercy for the day, and he will not be receptive to what I have to say. What does Mordechai say that counters Esther's logic with his own logic? In fact, what is Mordechai's logic? Just run into the palace and start crying and pleading? What likelihood of success would that be? If Esther takes a pacifist approach to crisis, Mordechai takes an activist approach. And there you have dueling logic. And Mordechai's logic is also compelling. He says that if a person's faced with a crisis, very often the crisis stays the same. Rarely does it get better. It usually gets worse. And the more we delay, the worse it can get. And you say, well, the king is so unpredictable, unstable, he'll change his mind the next day, may get rid of Haman. Yeah, maybe he'll get rid of you also. If you haven't been called to the king for 30 days, maybe he has soured on you. And therefore, maybe he'll replace you with someone else, like he did Vashti, and then this moment will be lost. And he said, and here I'm quoting Rav Aviner, that we have a small window of opportunity here, because the message just went out that day, Yud Gimel Nisan. It just went out. The edict will spread, and the preparations will begin. And once you give Haman's children, his supporters, his minions, Jew haters all, the notion that there's coming a day, 11 months from now, when it will be mutter to kill Jews across the land, every Jew, man, woman, and child, who says they're going to wait 11 months, right? If the day of reckoning is the 13th of Adar, 11 months ahead, does that mean if they kill someone on Yud Gimel Sivan or Elul, there'll be some punishment for it? There'll be recriminations from the palace? On the contrary, they killed Kolomed Lehorikdami. They're already dead, as far as the king is concerned. So what would be the difference whether they wait 11 months or 1 month? They'll just start preparing and killing Jews now. They'll find some pretext even earlier and start killing Jews. So he says, you may save yourself in the palace, but you won't save us. And in fact, he says, Rav quotes this quote, I think the Menos HaLevi, Al tadami v'nafsheich, you have your soul also to worry about. Physically, you might save yourself, but spiritually, you will not. And then he says something else. He says that the reason why he's in sackcloth and ashes, and the reason why he's pressing now, is because you're inside the palace and you're secure. But on the streets, Evel Gadol LaYehudim, it's a time of great mourning for Jews. The Jewish world is in an uproar. Fear, panic, terror. The situation is dire. It's much more dire than you realize. Don't think that what's required is normal politics and negotiation. And then he says, Umi yode im lo'eis kazos higat l'malchus. Who knows who says that you'll be queen in a month? Maybe he'll get rid of you too. The king is very unpredictable. He's killed one king already, and the king knows that the king knows that the edict has been signed. If Esther wants, so whenever she's called and raises the issue then, let's say she's called another week or another month, right? And she raises the issue then, the king is going to feel, well, how serious is this? How concerned could Esther be if she waited to see me, right? If something's an emergency, you call right away. You don't send a letter. If there's an emergency, right, you call. Actually, today people text, which is probably bad. Pick up a phone and call. You call someone, you go see them right away. The situation is dire. If Esther would wait, the king would say, well, she didn't really care that much, because why would she wait? So you have to show your sense of urgency by going now. Okay, which logic is better? What's that?
Active.
Esther's better.
Active.
Activist is better. Active. You see, Esther embraces that, because she says, Vatomer Esther lo shiv Mordechai. Esther then sends a message back to Mordechai, and she says, yes, you're right. Lech, I'm going right now. Lech kenosus kol hayudim hanimtzim b'shushan v'tsumu alai. Go gather all the Jews that are in Shushan and fast for me. Val tochlu val tishtu shloshes yomim laila v'yom. And don't eat, don't drink for 3 days, night and day. Gamani v'na'arosai atzum kein. So I and my maids will do the same. Uvechein avol ha-melech ha-shelo chados. And then I'll go to the king, ha-shelo chados, against the regulations. V'chasher avadati avadati. As I'll be lost, I'll be lost. What happens, happens. What's our argument? Very interesting. So we said it's the 13th of Nisan. What's coming up? Pesach. She says, I want everyone to fast. You, me, everyone else. 14 Nisan, 15 Nisan, 16 Nisan. 3 days. Okay? Mordechai responds to her, Medrash says in the Yalkut. Mordechai responds to her, 1 second, the Seder's coming. Women have cooked already. Some have booked places in hotels already across Persia. What's that? Across Europe, right. Across Persia. You can tell them they can't eat? Why are the Jews going to hotels to begin with? They can't eat. They're going to eat. How could you do that on Pesach? So Esther says to her, says to him, in the language of the Medrash, Zokein be Yisrael, elder of Israel, you're the one who said the situation is so urgent. If the situation is so urgent, so this year Pesach is not Pesach. It's a different Pesach. You know, in the Piyut, Vayhi b'chatzi alayla, so this incident is referenced there as one of the things that happened the night of Pesach. Okay. Well, why did she agree? Why didn't she then respond in kind that her approach might work? Why did she agree with Mordechai? So Mordechai made a very strong argument. And it's an argument that goes really to the heart of many things that exist in Jewish life. Many issues arise, many decisions that have to be made, and there is always this tension between those who counsel patience and passivity and those who counsel activism and self-help. The Torah really counsels action more than passivity. You can't say the Torah says never to be passive, right? Sometimes you have to be passive and just get a better assessment of the situation. But for the most part, the Torah counsels action. Haba lahargecha, hashkem lahargo. If a person comes to kill you, you don't have to wait to respond, or certainly flee. Hashkem, you get up early to kill him. That's self-defense. Don't wait. And then he says, Yeshua, salvation. The way of the Torah is that salvation comes first from our deeds, from what we do. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds. You have two models, though. It is true. In fact, Arav mentions this, that you take the case, also happened Pesach night, of Sancheiriv's army. Sancheiriv came, Ashur, Jews were surrounded, Chizkiah was the king, there was panic, the rest of Eretz Yisrael, Yehudah, Yisrael had been already conquered, Yerushalayim was under siege, and they had no option but tefillah. and tshuva. And so the Navi tells us, and we reference this also in the Haggadah, that night Malach Hashem killed the army of Sennacherib, 185,000 strong. The army was killed in a plague. But that's a rare instance, and those instances happen when we can't do anything else, when there's nothing left to do, meaning when a Jew is at his wit's end and has exhausted every possibility of salvation, then all we're left with is tefillah. There's nothing else. It happens that a person has to see a doctor, all right? You can't rely on tefillah. Sir Ramban says tzaddikim do, but the normal person does it. We rely on tefillah. We rely on science, on medicine, on God as the Rofei Cholam Yisrael. It's only when there's nothing left to do, then all you're left with is tefillah. But that notion of passivity, that is only the last resort, that's not the initial resort. Passivity usually results in one of two possibilities. Both of them not very salutary for us. The first is the situation's exacerbated. And then you thought you could have halted a decline at a certain point, right? And now it's become much more worse. I remember my first day in college, and one of the first classes I took was in defense policy, and just how they scheme, you know, different war games and things like that, whether to go to war or not. And the question ultimately comes up, and it's really done in sense of equations even. If you fight now and suffer two X casualties, is that better than fighting 5 years from now and suffering four X casualties? Now, of course, part of the, you'd say it's obvious. What's not obvious, what makes it actually a speculation, is that, well, who knows that whether you'll have to fight 3 or 4 years from now. Maybe you won't have to. But if you assess that you'll have to fight at a certain point, a year, two, three down the road, but by then your security situation would have deteriorated more, you wind up with more casualties, then it's far better to fight on your terms with limited casualties than in the future. And that's why Israel preempted the Egyptian and Syrian-Jordanian attack in the Six-Day War. Because they felt if they would absorb the first blow, they'd be in a much more inferior position to respond. So they attacked first. How often is this dilemma encountered? The logic of passivity versus the logic of activism? Every great decision. In fact, almost all of my series, Great Decisions this year, we encounter that very phenomenon. Sometimes in terms of war and peace, sometimes other things, usually war because that's where it's most obvious to us, whether to attack first in June 67, whether to attack first in 1973. Notice they did in the first case, not in the second case, and the response, the outcome was predictable once they made that choice to attack, even to declare a state. That was an obvious one. A lot of pressure not to declare a state from the Americans, from others, even within Israel, because they knew a war would come, right? The war would come if they declared a state. The war would not necessarily come if they didn't declare a state, and it was left to negotiations. Nonetheless, they made the decision. Ben-Gurion forced it through, properly so, to declare a state, to attack the Iraqi reactor or not in June 1981, to attack the Iranian reactor, plants now, more than just a reactor, or not to attack. You see, that dance is going on now at least a decade, maybe two decades, and from the time when it could have been handled more easily, one plant, maybe it was already divided years ago, but let's say two or three plants, now it's 5 to 10 plants, maybe a dozen plants, manufacturing different types of weaponry, and it sourced different types of weaponry, nuclear, plutonium, atomic, etc., heavy water, light water, it's all liquids, it's all dangerous. But now it's a much more unmanageable situation than it was years ago. So you wait, things get worse. At the end, if you attack, things get worse also. You certainly do change the dynamic. Rav Avinah writes, and it's always good to remind ourselves whenever there are tsaros on the horizon, that the Jewish people are guaranteed survival. That is a promise God made to us. And there's no doubt at all that that's why we exist until today. but for that promise, HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Klal Yisrael, we would not exist. It's as simple as that. But one corollary of that promise, of that formula, is we are first obligated to do our hishtadlus, to do what we have to do. There's an interesting comment of Rav Kook on this very idea in Ein Ayah, in Shabbos, the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Lamed Beis. The Gemara speaks about first crossing a bridge and then taking a rickety boat across a river to get from one side to the other. So the Gemara says, the Rav lo over b'mivra de yosebe oved kochavim. Rav would not cross on a boat, on a ferry, on which there were non-Jews there, because he didn't want to have to suffer their fate. Dilma mifkadle dina ale umatfisna bade. Maybe, you know, their Rishom, God will decree that they have to, they're finished. And I'll suffer as a result of them. He didn't. So he didn't cross. Shmuel over el b'mivra de ispe oved kochavim. Shmuel, conversely, would only cross on a ferry that had non-Jews. Omer, sitna v'tre ume lo shalet. You don't have the satan prosecuting two different nations, Jews and non-Jews. So he felt safe in the company of non-Jews, right? Yeah, what are the safest airlines in the world? Besides Halal? The Arab airlines, because they're the ones doing the terrorism, not blowing up their own planes. So those will be the safest ones. That was his attitude, right? Take a ferry that has, if people are going to kill Jews, they'll kill Jews. They're not going to kill more non-Jews to get to one Jew. Rav Yanai Bodik V'Avar. So the Gemara says, Rav Yanai would just check the ferry to see whether the ferry's in good shape, period. If the boat's in good condition, then take it. Bad condition, don't take it. That's pretty obvious. So on this, Rav Kook comments in Ein Ayah, Ein lecha mida tova ba'olam shel tucha l'shtabesh b'dei briyot l'grom hepech me'avchamin shelo. There's no good trait in the world that cannot be distorted by people so the exact opposite comes out. And he goes on to say that many people in the world look for some type of sign or wonder in order to determine how they should go, how they should move, what decision to make. And he says, no doubt one of the greatest, holiest midos we have, midata bitachon, b'shem Hashem yisbarach, to trust in God. There's no greater mida that a Jew can have than to trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that should be the very foundation of our lives. But what's the purpose of bitachon b'shem? We're utterly reliant on God. Okay. But then he says, sometimes this precious mida can be a stumbling block for people. How so? Shilotia hasibola atzlut uleshiflut yodayim. Shehu ahepuch me'ashloma mititchel adam. It should not become a cause of laziness or idleness of hands, which is the opposite of the true perfection of the human being. Al ken kol mash adam yoter davek bekono. So the more a person cleaves to his Creator, and the stronger he is in this trait of trust in God, the more he should be assiduous and diligent in acting, in doing what he or she has to do, L'man yedu cholom ki atar gadolah shel midat ha-bitachon. So everybody should know that the great crown of bitachon, like all the holy, the holy traits that come from knowledge of God and yiras Hashem, etc., it all comes from our actions, from what we do. That's the system that God set up for us that we should act. So Rabbi Yanai badak va'avar. Rabbi Yanai would check, make sure the ship was in good condition, and then he would proceed. Without that, can't. Bitachon should never be the cause of laziness. Atzlut v'shiflut yadayim. So here Mordechai told Esther that, in fact, God will solve the national problem. Im hacharesh tacharishi. If you are silent at this time, Revach v'atzala yamod la'yehudim mimakom acher. You can rest assured that God will solve the national problem, because harbe shluchim l'makom. God has many, many agents that he could use, but God will not be able to solve your personal problem. The fact that you abandon your people at this time of need, that when action was called for, you chose passivity. That will not sit well. That will not help you. That will not help anyone at all. So, in fact, there's no doubt it's complicated. The whole situation was complicated. Keep in mind, you know, activism is wonderful, but you have to be focused also. You can't just be impulsive, impetuous, right? I could see very easily that Jewish defense groups, what would be the initial response? Kill Haman. Kill Achashverosh. If you kill them, problem is solved. The truth is, if you kill them, problem is not solved. On the contrary, you kill Haman, you'll just unleash a series of pogroms across the kingdom. And the king will have no interest in protecting the Jews. Kill Achashverosh, be succeeded by a worse king, be succeeded by Haman, for all you know. So it has to be done with a forethought, but you need action as well. And then he says, really powerful words, you know, the darsh in different ways, but mi yodeh im la'is kazos higat l'machuz. And Rashi says, who says you'll be the queen a year from now? But the Ibn Ezra says what it really sounds like, in essence, who knows if this is not your moment? All the strange things that have happened to us. Chazal say they were married, he raised her, she was much younger than him, but they had a long relationship. Strange things happen. You, of all people, a married woman, older woman even, she wasn't a young starlet. An older woman is taken into the palace, and over all the other women who are there, becomes the queen's consort. It's just odd. Maybe all these odd things are happening for this reason, right? Everything's inexplicable, but now maybe here's the explication. Maybe this is exactly why it's happening. So is action always better? Tactically, it's always better to act, change the dynamic. No doubt you do change the situation when you act, as opposed to remaining passive and letting things happen. But nonetheless, you see, Esther then, really acting in accordance with her nature, decided to go, right? Take the initiative. But what was her plan? What was the substance of her plan? Essentially passive. To wait. To plant the seeds. Right? What do they say? Sow the bait? No, it can't be. It's mixing metaphors. To anybody fish here would know what it means? No one fishes. You buy it in a jar. That's it. Already cut. Already cut. No one fishes. A lot of patience. I used to go with my grandfather while fishing when I was young. What's that? Hook the bait. That's what it is. Okay, see? Right. You have to hook the bait, because what's the problem? See, Esther's very coy. Esther's very restrained. Esther's very rational. She knows, it sounds almost like, what does Mordechai want? Go to the king, all right, and tell the king they want to kill us. And Esther then realized, yeah, you know, tactically the approach is good. I'll go to the king, I won't wait, but I can't do that. Because if I just go and jump him, he's going to be very serious. He's not going to respond. You have to know Achashverosh. So then she devised the plan in accordance with her own thinking. We don't know how it's going to turn out, but nonetheless, a full frontal attack on Achashverosh is also not going to work. So therefore, Esther has to be very deliberate. So what does she say to Mordechai? Now that it's in my hands, okay, now I'll listen to you, but now you have to do this also. First, what's your end? Tefillah. Tshuva. Lech kenosas kol yehudim v'tzumu alai. Tzom. You have to fast. Do tshuva. You have to daven. That's your end. And I, uvechein avor lamelech asher lo chadas. I'll go. I'll listen to you. I will move the action forward. I'll take the initiative. But it has to be done on my terms. Because if I just go in, it's not going to work. So what does she do? Plant seeds. After everything, goes to Achashverosh, by the grace of Hashem, king sees Perikei Pasuk Beis. Vahi charos hamelech Esther malka omedes bechatzir nas ochein beinov. Esther had that charm, that grace. You know what chein is? Likeability. The media people call it the Q factor, right? They measure people's likability. On television, radio, it's actors, actresses. Chein is really the Q factor. Do people like you or not? If chein, tzochein v'sechel tov elokim v'yotam. You person, you're like, you're, people like you. They like to be around you, all right? Chein. Vayoshet hamelech l'aster eshavir ha-zohov asher b'yado. He extends that scepter. She touches the scepter as a sign of intimacy. And then the king says to her, so now that she's been granted the audience, she knows the king is not going to respond to a plea, to a supplication, to a cry. All right? What does she say? Just come. I have an invitation to extend to you. Come tomorrow to a mishteh, you and Haman, that I'm making. Mishteh. All right, this king never turns down an invitation to a mishteh. It's a good idea. But of course, had she made the request right away, what would have happened? So now the king's in conflict. He has Haman, trusted confidant, Mishneh Lamelech on the one hand, and Esther, basically unknown to him still, he likes her, but she's really unknown origin even, and there's a conflict between the two. Esther realizes that that's not going to work. So she has to play on the psyche of Ahasuerus, on his weaknesses, on his paranoia, and then she plants the seed of Haman, and then of course Maruas Haman, tell Haman to come. Next day, Mishteh, and the king repeats the request to Esther. Again, what do you want? What can I do for you? Ad chatzia malchus. And Esther says again, I'll tell you what I want. Come to another mishteh. All right? Now it's tantalizing. And of course, that night, balayla hahu, nodado shnas hamelech. Then HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes and sends the king other messages, other factors, undermining the king's absolute reliability in Haman. Now he sees Haman as a bit of an adversary, and that just lays the foundation, the framework for the end of the story. But in fact, what Esther did was prey on Ahasuerus's insecurities, his weaknesses, and allow the Hashgacha to take over. So you see, in fact, in the dueling logic, they both prevailed, because Esther adopted Mordechai's approach to be proactive, but at the same time, she acted in her own way in a very restrained, almost passive way, just feeding Ahasuerus or dragging Ahasuerus slowly, little by little, bringing him into her orbit so that she'd be able to work the Yeshua for Klal Yisrael. And that's what happened, and that's really the bottom line. Know that I think activism, like Aviva said, activism is always preferred, because then you're the one in control and you're the one who can adapt to a situation that really you're more aware of what is happening, of the ramifications, than anyone else. Now, obviously in battle, the one who attacks first always has the advantage, because he knows where he's going and he knows how to get there, and the others can just respond. Look, some military assaults fail also, but usually the element of surprise is dominant, because you control the battlefield. You know what you're doing, and the other side doesn't. But you can't just be heavy-handed either and throw every resource at a particular location, because if that fails, there is no plan B. So Esther used her approach also. She used her approach of caution, right, of trying to lure Ahasuerus into a better place, and in fact that happened. And that, the tzom, the tefillah, the tshuva, and the compelling but dueling logic of both, we're all employed in order to see Yeshua's Hashem. Yes?
Yes, she also engaged everybody, all the Jews.
Everyone, that's correct.
So that part was active too. But what was the point of Mordechai just wailing in his sackcloth? You know, to tell everybody, or could he go directly to Esther instead?
Attention. Yeah, I mean, what's the modern equivalent of wailing? I guess you post it on Facebook, right? Because remember, the edict was sent out, but it wasn't publicized.
Right.
The people didn't know. It was sent to the governors. What's the pasuk say? It was sent to the governors of each of the provinces, but it didn't... let's see, it's pasuk gimel. Where is it sent out? Right. Vayikaseh kol shel melech el achash tapenei melech apachos. Right. El Surei Am Va'am, Medina U'Medina Kichsova Am Vam Kilshono. It was sent out to the Surei Am, to the leaders, the officers. It was not sent out to all the people.
So they didn't know.
People didn't know. The commoners didn't know. They would be advised of it. That only came, that would come much later on. But in the initial instance, because it was happening in Shushan, and of course Mordechai was tied to the palace as well, so, and he knew of who he had a relationship with Haman, a relationship of enemies, of course, but it was a relationship. So he knew what Haman was plotting, and therefore that was the way to get out. If there's, if word is publicized that there's, and Mordechai was a prominent figure amongst the Jews also, if he's in the king's courtyard, wailing, crying, bemoaning their fate, that's how the Jews of Shushan found out. As a matter of fact, if you look at the end of Perek Gimel, it shows the progression, really, because it says the word got out, right? Vo'ir Shushan Navocha. What's Navocha?
Confused, perplexed,
confused, correct. So something happened, they knew it was bad, they didn't know the extent of it, and that's the next pasuk. So the Jews of Shushan went from being perplexed, okay, when they saw Mordechai b'socha'ir crying, zaka gedolo umara, and then once the word then spread, b'chol midon medina, evil gedol ayhudim, they went from being navocha, perplexed, to being avelim, to being mourners, and that's how the word spread. That's how Mordechai did it. And that's how Mordechai knew he would get Esther's attention as well. And that's what they did. As soon as it happened, though, Mordechai endeavored to say, let's nip this in the bud immediately, go to the king and beg the king. And that's when Esther demurred and said, that's not the approach. I'll go to the king, but it has to be done gradually in order to wean the king away from his nefarious intentions and bring him into our orbit. Okay, I thank you very much.
Not next week.
Next week, no, I'll be the